Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we address the apparent armed provocation staged on the border of Venezuela and Brazil, aimed at bringing about U.S. military intervention. Next, we discuss the voter fraud in North Carolina. Then, we talk with the attorney for Hoda Mutana, the Alabama woman who joined ISIS at 19 and wants to return home to the United States. And then, news broke that Julian Assange has received a passport from Australia. And finally, our regular Friday segment, Worst and Most Misleading Headlines of the Week. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Israeli soldiers killed a 14-year-old Palestinian today. The Palestinian Health Ministry spokesman said the boy was shot in the chest during demonstrations to the east of Gaza City. The Great March of Return started almost a year ago with protests every Friday since March 30th, 2018. Cuban residents are voting on Sunday for a new constitution. The vote follows a series of open community meetings where residents debated and amended the constitutional proposals. The last constitution was written in 1976, and more than 6 million people are registered to vote on Sunday. Congressional Democrats today released a resolution of disapproval aimed at President Trump's declaration of a national emergency. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that it will be voted on in the House on Tuesday, where it's expected to sail through due to the Democratic majority. The Republican-controlled Senate will be more difficult and may not even come up for a vote, with just one Republican coming out to support it so far, that's Senator Susan Collins from Maine. Those are today's headlines. You are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Venezuela. As the U.S. effort to overthrow the Venezuelan government has run into obstacles within Venezuela, there appears to be a growing danger of a U.S.-orchestrated military intervention in alliance between the Pentagon and the right-wing governments of Colombia and Brazil. U.S. corporate-owned media today were dominated by headlines related to an incident at the Venezuelan-Brazil border. The New York Times headline, for instance, reads, "Deadly violence erupts on Brazil border in Venezuela aid showdown. Venezuelan security forces fired on those protesting the government's determination to block aid." That's the New York Times headline. Meanwhile, competing concerts are still scheduled to take place today and tomorrow on both sides of the Venezuelan-Colombian border. We're joined from Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Paul Dobson, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, undoubtedly, I would have to say the news about Venezuela is reaching a fever pitch here in the U.S. corporate-owned media. There can't be anything but a sense that there is a growing crisis. When we've talked to you and to Lucas Kerner and to others in Venezuela over the past weeks, we did not have the impression that there was a growing sense of alarm or crisis in the day-to-day life of normal, average, ordinary Venezuelans. But nonetheless, there seems to be a growing sense of crisis, perhaps at the borders. Anyway, help us understand what's going on.
Without a doubt, this weekend is a flashpoint in the ongoing political crisis, which has been initiated and stimulated by the White House. We have seen, obviously, apart from the border incidents, which we'll talk a little bit more about just now, we're also seeing in Caracas, for example, the beginning of the International Assembly of the Peoples, which has seen hundreds and hundreds of well-known figures, academics, journalists, and social leaders flock to Caracas to attend this assembly in support of the constitutional government of Venezuela. We're seeing nearly daily protests, mass protests, not just in Caracas, but in other parts of the country against U.S. imperialism and rejecting the threats of intervention into the country. And of course, early this morning, we saw an incident on the Brazilian border. Still a little bit unclear exactly as to what happened. What we can gather is that a group of indigenous citizens close to the border with Brazil tried to block a military convoy which was en route to close the border following the wording of the orders of President Maduro. We're not quite sure what happened at the confrontation. However, there have been reports that two indigenous citizens have died as a result. There are also rumors that the indigenous community kidnapped three high-ranking military officers, although these reports are yet to be confirmed. On the Colombian border as well, we're seeing mass amounts of people flock to the border for both of the concerts you mentioned, the one on the Colombian side and on the Venezuelan side, and tensions are definitely growing.
Let's talk about the two concerts. In Colombia, we see the fingerprints of Sir Richard Branson. He's from the UK. I don't know why he's there. Again, Colombia has a right-wing government. Marco Rubio's down there. What's the point of that concert? It's purportedly to support the idea of humanitarian aid coming into Venezuela. And likewise, the rival concert inside Venezuela. How close are the two concerts?
Fairly close. One is obviously at the on the Venezuelan side of the international border in a town called San Antonio de Táchira on the Simón Bolívar international border. And the other one is maybe 20 minutes away on another international border in Tienditas on the Colombian side. We're also seeing a heavy military presence from both governments at the moment. We've seen U.S. military on the Colombian side of the border in recent days. Three large cargo planes arrived with all the military personnel and we don't know what else about 3 or 4 days ago. And obviously there's a lot of talk about what is going on at the border. The opposition concert is calling for the entry of humanitarian aid, or what they call humanitarian aid, into the country. And the pro-government concert is under the title of Hands Off Venezuela. So they are calling for a rejection of U.S. threats and a respect for the sovereignty of the country.
Paul Dobson is our guest. Paul, what's the mood in Venezuela?
Well, as I explained, this weekend it is starting to heat up a little bit, although the vast majority of the country is entirely calm at the moment. We're not seeing any road blockades being set up. We're not seeing any sort of shift in the power dynamics, which would indicate that there is an imminent coup or an imminent success of the coup which is currently going on. The rest of the country, people are going out to work, to the schools, to the hospitals, doing their shopping and so on as usual. Tomorrow we are expecting to see large right-wing oppositions, right-wing protests across the country, with obviously the focus being on the border regions. But we have also seen pro-government supporters mobilize to defend the country's right to self-determination.
The indigenous communities in Brazil in recent weeks have been putting out calls protesting what they see as the potential genocidal impact of the policies, the anti-indigenous policies of the Bolsonaro government. Here you have this clash again, seeming to pit the indigenous community against the progressive government of Venezuela. I just wonder how this all plays out. You know, I'm thinking back to every time the U.S. has gone into a military confrontation, there has to be a pretext, and the pretext has to be associated with a noble cause, the defense of civilians, the defense of minority communities, opposition to weapons of mass destruction, stopping terrorism. In the case of Nicaragua, I can remember the U.S. was supporting, and Elliot Abrams was supporting, the Contra war against the Sandinista government. At a certain point, there was also a manipulation by the CIA Contra war of some parts of an indigenous population in Nicaragua, such that it could give the appearance that the Sandinista government was no longer simply fighting Yankee imperialism, but was somehow now the oppressor of an indigenous community in Nicaragua, something that became highly utilitarian for the propaganda demonizing the Sandinistas. Without knowing facts, we don't know exactly what's going on at the border and in this instance. But given some of this history, is some of that possible?
Without a doubt. And this is pretty much what we've been seeing over the last 5 years or so in relation to right-wing protests here in Venezuela, a number of which have followed the following course of events. Small groups of right-wing youth protests. They start throwing Molotov cocktails at government institutions, even nurseries, hospitals, things like this, start trying to burn them down, start shooting from the rooftops. The armed forces or the National Guard are then called upon to restore public order, which obviously involves a confrontation given the nature of the protesters. As a result, some are either arrested or unfortunately harmed in the protest, and international mainstream media reports this as repression by the dictator. No? And so there is definitely a precedent there. It's also worth pointing out that the indigenous communities in that area of the country have, for a long time, had an ongoing spat with the government, essentially revolving around mining rights. The indigenous communities frequently practice illegal mining, or illegal according to the government's interpretation of the word, and the government have been trying in the last 2 or 3 years to regulate the mining industry in that sector, which has obviously been confronted with resistance by the very lucrative miners who stem from the indigenous communities. So we have seen numerous confrontations. The last one was only in December, a couple of months ago, between the Pemon indigenous groupings and government security forces. So this is the recent confrontation has to definitely been seen in that context. I'm not indicating that mining was the cause of the confrontation. It seems to be more revolved around the closing of the Brazilian border. However, there is certainly plenty of bad will between this particular indigenous community, which is unique in its anti-government stance. The vast majority of the indigenous communities in Venezuela are pro-government, but this particular community is anti-government, and the security forces, which are carrying out the orders of the government.
Let's just talk about, this is February 23rd coming up in the United States and around the United States and in other countries as well. There are protests taking place. We're going to be outside in downtown Washington tomorrow. There's going to be activities here in New York, all over the place. Upcoming on March 16th, there's going to be a large-scale protest in Washington, D.C., opposing the Trump administration's efforts to inaugurate a coup. Growing solidarity, and at the same time, it seems a steadfast determination on the part of the coup makers, meaning the Trump administration and its allies like Marco Rubio, that they're going to go for it, that this is not going to go away. If they did not succeed at first, they'll keep trying, try, and try again. We're heading towards some sort of climax. We don't know exactly when, but it really is the kind of situation where if you care about international law or justice or self-determination, it seems to me people have to speak up and speak out against what the United States is doing. We have 30 seconds left. You take us out.
Well, we've certainly seen that Washington's man here in Venezuela is failing in his objective to take power in the country. But of course, this worryingly pushes him down the path of foreign military intervention as the only means to which he can actually assume a presidency. So the longer that the government stays in power here, the threat of foreign intervention is in fact more likely. And this will mean huge bloodshed, not just for Venezuelans, but for other peoples across the region, and will entirely destabilize the whole of Latin America, and therefore must be opposed for anyone who supports a diplomatic solution to this situation.
All right, that was the voice of Paul Dobson. We were speaking to him from Venezuela. Paul is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. A court in North Carolina has ordered a rerun of the congressional election in the state's 9th district because of election fraud. We're joined from New York by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com, R-A-L-L.com. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst. Ted, Walter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Okay. Election fraud, Ted Rawl, is not that unusual in this, the greatest democracy in the world. But what is unusual is that an election is actually rerun as a consequence of the revelations of fraud. Pretty big, right?
It's big news. Obviously, the first thing that most people who heard this story probably thought about was Bush v. Gore 2000 in Florida. Why couldn't we have a do-over back then? It's not to say that this is a simple matter. It's expensive, and the outcome will be different. I mean, you're not going to get all the same people to show back up at the polls a second time, and you could even end up with a very surprising result. But I think it's the only way to proceed in when situations like this arise.
Walter, election fraud, North Carolina, Georgia. I mean, this comes at the same time that there has been a weakening of the Voting Rights Act all over the disputed areas of the South, which would include North Carolina. Election suppression, election fraud, not unimportant in terms of election and electioneering in America.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, there's instances of outright fraud, which is apparently what we've seen in this congressional election in the 9th District of North Carolina. But then there's the much broader structural problems with elections in the United States. I mean, the first and foremost is the history and ongoing practice of racist voter suppression, whether that takes the form of, for instance, in Texas, right, there were ICE agents conducting, quote unquote, training operations near majority Latino precincts. Or, in Georgia, there was, the suppression, the disenfranchisement of large numbers of African-American voters. There's in Florida, for instance, a huge percentage of Black voters are actually just barred, and this is up until the recent referendum, were barred from participating in the election because they were caught up in the racist criminal justice system, right, and had a criminal record and therefore were stripped of their voting rights. A lot of that's changed now because of the initiative of grassroots organizers. But, that was a feature of Florida elections, and elections in Florida are pretty important, right, when you think about the overall national trajectory of the country. So there are all of these structural problems built into the election process, and that's not even touching on the influence of corporate money or the media or the fact that elections are ludicrously held on a Tuesday when people have to work.
Ted Rall, the State Board of Elections in North Carolina originally delayed certifying the vote in this congressional district and now has voted 5-0 to have a new election. They accuse a political operative of the Republican candidate who won by a very narrow margin, about 900 votes. His last name is Dowless. He's a political operative in the area. He's accused of leading an effort that had workers encouraging voters to request an absentee ballot, then collecting those ballots and turning them in, which is illegal in North Carolina. Again, it's an issue really of ballot tampering. But the fact that the vote is 5-0, that would indicate to me that there's been a clear sort of affirmation or assumption that this fraud actually did take place.
Yeah, that and the idea that you evidently have five people of integrity on this board. It's good to see. The fact that it's so unusual, considering the long history of fraudulent elections, as Walter pointed out, in the United States, is sad. But I'd like to think that it's the beginning of things to come. Of course, obviously, it's going to be a problem to have, half of our elections held several times over. What happens if the do-over election is fraudulent, too? I mean, there could be no end to this. But it's certainly it's good to see.
Stacey Abrams, who delivered the Democratic Party's rebuttal to Donald Trump's State of the Union address, she argued and asserted, Walter, that there was a lot of voter suppression during the election in Georgia for the governor. Again, she lost. It was amazing that she almost could win, a Black woman in the state of Georgia. But what we saw there was that the Secretary of State in Georgia, who himself was running for office against her, was closing down polling places in the Black community. So Black voters would have to go far away to vote. I mean, that seems to be pretty obvious.
It's absolutely obvious. It's a return to the old Jim Crow tactics of intimidation and fraud and suppression that had been not ended, but, substantially curtailed by, the Voting Rights Act, which you mentioned earlier, one of the key victories of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, which more or less put the southern states under federal supervision when it comes to election laws. And just a number of local pieces of legislation that were passed. Voter ID laws is a pretty common example of this, a popular form of voter suppression. Voter ID laws requiring people to, present photo ID before they vote, which is something that, poor people are overwhelmingly less likely to have. I mean, any sort of middle class person who would, generally more commonly vote for Republicans, they have photo ID, but that's not the case for everybody. So there's all these different tactics to get around these key victories. And then when the Supreme Court said, okay, it's actually not constitutional, that, the key provision of the Voting Rights Act that puts these states under federal supervision, then, the floodgates were opened and all sorts of things like this could happen. What happened to Stacey Abrams is horrible in Georgia. The suppression of Black voters by Camp, right, who is active as the Secretary of State.
And the Secretary of State monitors the election.
They're in charge of
the
election.
And he's running against her.
Yeah, right. So he didn't, like, step down because it's an obvious conflict of interest. He retained his old position. Now, I think it was unfortunate that in Stacey Abrams' rebuttal to the State of the Union address, she said that, the U.S. national politics should become more like Georgia politics. I don't want that to happen either.
Yeah, that was odd. That was odd. She also said she hopes Donald Trump doesn't fail. I guess that was like a way of expressing the need for bipartisanship. But, I hope Donald Trump fails on a whole number of issues. Let's go back. Ted Rall, Brian Kemp, the person we're talking about, this is in nearby, not in North Carolina, but two states away in Georgia. He is Secretary of State running against Stacey Abrams. In addition to a massive purge of voter rolls on the basis that there might be a problem with the number of the registrations, he also put 53,000 voter registrations on hold right then and there, right before the election. 53,000. And guess what? 70% of them happen to be black people. I mean, you can't, in a way, get more brazen than this. And yet, here we have the situation. North Carolina, a new vote. Georgia, same old, same old.
Elections are, along with public education, a good argument against states' rights and slow state control of any kind of governance. There's been so many examples of this kind of thing. The Secretary of State's office is a job that most American voters never give a passing thought to. They think the federal Secretary of State, which is, of course, foreign policy. But what's really bizarre is that the Secretary of State position is a political position appointed by the governor of a state, and that the Secretary of State can have a brazenly political role and politicize the role of counting the votes in a way that we saw, for example, in Florida in 2000 with Bush v. Gore, where the Secretary of State, who had been appointed by George W. Bush's brother, the governor at the time, brazenly manipulated the vote count in Florida. In 2004, the same thing happened in the key state of Ohio, where the Secretary of State was an active member of the Bush campaign and arranged to have voting booths pulled out of majority African-American voting districts in the inner cities in Ohio and removed to the white suburbs in order to make sure that the lines were really long and a lot of people would be discouraged from voting because they had to get back to work on a Tuesday. And it's sort of a system that's meant to be corrupt. It's designed for corruption. If it's not corrupt, there's something broken about it.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Ted Rall about the rerun that was ordered in the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina. And we're also talking about elections in the United States in general and how they're manipulated and marred by racism and all sorts of other types of injustices. Ted, in this conversation, we would be remiss if we didn't mention that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, actually lost the election by like 3 million votes, right? I mean, it's pretty absurd that we have a system where, the person who gets the most votes doesn't always become the president, right? I mean, and it's not like this is the first time. George W. Bush, who we've been talking about too, another example in the 2000 election where he got less votes but then became the president. There's just so many things about the U.S. electoral system that kind of, just boggles the mind.
For sure. And of course, obviously, there's the weird primary system, which serves as a feeder and a continuity system for a two-party system to make it incredibly difficult for a third party to get off the ground, pretty much impossible. And even if you're a multi-billionaire like Ross Perot was, the thing is, the United States should probably stop calling itself a major democracy because it's really not a democratic system. And it's barely really even a representative system. It's sort of rough representation within very narrow ideological boundaries between, corporate Democrat and corporate Republican. And most of the ideological spectrum cannot be represented. And very often, the person that you vote for, even if you're in the majority, will not assume office. There's all manner of chicanery and trickery always at work. And it's kind of a miracle that the American people are not even more discouraged than they are in terms of turnout. We do have one of the lowest voter turnouts of any Western quote-unquote democracy. But I'm surprised it's as high as it is, because the system is really so, it's sort of functionally dysfunctional, is I think the best way to put it.
That was the voice of Ted Rawl. He joined us from New York. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com. That's R-A-L-L.com. We were also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Hoda Muthanna is an American woman. She was born in the United States, the daughter of a former Yemeni diplomat, and she went to college in Alabama. But in 2014, she told her parents that she was going to attend a university event. Instead, she went to Syria and she joined the Islamic State. But now she wants to come home. President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo won't allow her. Indeed, Pompeo says that she isn't even really a U.S. citizen. We'll discuss that by speaking with Hassan Shibley from Tampa, Florida. He is the Muthanna family attorney and the executive director of the Florida Council of Islamic Relations at Tampa. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
Can you tell us something about the controversy over her passport, over her citizenship? It seems that Secretary of State Pompeo's statement yesterday that she had no passport and that she wasn't really an American citizen was factually incorrect. Can you explain that to us?
It is extremely factually incorrect, and it changed the whole conversation. Look, we all agree ISIS is evil. Those who support them in violation of the law should be held accountable. Nobody's disputing that. But what we truly believe as attorneys and as Americans is that the president himself does not have the authority to unilaterally declassify an individual who's an American citizen. The president doesn't have the authority to declassify them as an American citizen and strip them of their citizenship just by presidential declaration and a command to the Secretary of State. That's not how our country works. Citizenship is one of the most fundamental rights enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, and it is guaranteed to all people born in the United States whose parents were not diplomats at the time that they were born. Now, in this case, the facts are as follows. Huda's father stopped being a diplomat as of June 1st of 1994. By September 1st of 1994, the United States diplomatic mission was made aware that Huda's father no longer had diplomatic immunity, no longer had diplomatic status. The case law is very clear that once a person ceases to be acting in their diplomatic capacity, they lose that diplomatic immunity. However, there is sometimes a grace period that's granted. That grace period, the case law has shown, is about 30 days. Nonetheless, Huda Muthanna was born almost 2 months after that, at the end of October 1994. She's an American citizen. Her father had long ceased to be a diplomat before she was born. And it's preposterous for the government for the president to circumvent our legal system by wrongfully saying she's not a citizen. It's mind boggling. And essentially what he's doing is he's giving her a free pass. He's saying that she's not a citizen, therefore not subject to our jurisdiction. And that's essentially giving her a free pass while she herself acknowledges that she was horribly misguided, deeply regrets what she's done, and is willing to face our legal system as an American to be held accountable.
How old was she when she went to Syria?
She had just turned 20.
Yeah, so she was very young. There's actually a very similar case taking place in the UK right now. And in fact, the UK government has also stripped a UK citizen of her citizenship. And ironically, it's the conservatives who are lining up in the UK to say, wait a minute, there is a due process violation here. The woman has not had due process, and you can't just arbitrarily strip someone of their citizenship. It's the same situation here in the United States. So where is Hoda Muthanna right now? Is she in the United States yet? Is she being held somewhere, or is she overseas waiting to come back?
Some time ago, she actually ran away from ISIS territory as they were firing bullets at her, as ISIS snipers were firing at her, and she headed in the direction of the Syrian Democratic Forces, who are U.S. allies on the ground in northeast Syria. She identified herself as American and said, listen, I want to turn myself in. So she's been in one of the Syrian Democratic Forces refugee camps since she's turned herself in.
This is such an important case. You know, again, as our guest has said, you can completely denounce and condemn ISIS for what it is, as he does, and as people who also recognize that the U.S. Constitution is still the law of the land, And if the American president, any president, can say, guess what, the Constitution no longer applies to a particular American citizen or to the government itself in terms of its own restrictions on its authority, then we're going down a very, very dangerous road. It's a slippery slope. I want to read for our audience what the 14th Amendment of the United States says. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. When you think about the 14th Amendment, again, that was the end of the enslavement and the non-citizenship status of Black Americans in the South. What we see here is a precedent being set, which, while dangerous and awful for this particular individual, will actually be applied elsewhere because once a precedent is set, it's the precedent. Go ahead.
Exactly. I mean, what's really ironic about all of this at the end of the day is that Huda is asking to protect the U.S. legal system, to be subject to the U.S. legal system. The president is essentially giving her a free pass for what she's done by claiming she's not a citizen and therefore not subject to our laws and our jurisdiction. But in doing so is very dangerously undermining the Constitution, which is the very soul and foundation of our nation. And therefore, Huda, somebody who admittedly at a point went down a very dark, very anti-American path, now is in essence becoming a champion for protecting the U.S. Constitution by fighting this case that was just filed on her behalf by CLCMA and Attorney Charlie Swift in saying, listen, the president cannot unilaterally strip somebody of citizenship without process of law and contravention to the facts. And we have to fight this case as a presidential check, a check on executive overreach and executive power. It doesn't matter who the president is. It doesn't matter if he's Democrat or Republican. Presidents serve the nation and serve and protect the Constitution. We cannot allow them to trump the Constitution in that regard.
You posted something on Twitter 2 days ago that I think is very important that I wanted to read. This is what you tweeted. We must put up a fight. This is much bigger and broader than Huda Muthanna. This is about presidential overreach and attempt to strip citizenship without due process. Donald Trump will use this against Latinos to strip birthright citizenship. Must fight to protect Constitution.
That's important.
That's very important. And in fact, that's something that came up 2 years ago, just after Donald Trump was inaugurated. There was a discussion coming out of the administration about stripping Latinos of birthright citizenship. This is a slippery slope, and it's something that has a direct impact on American civil liberties. What kind of a response are you getting to this tweet?
It's a mix. There's a lot of people who are, I mean, I've had people who say, listen, they're Trump voters, they're Trump supporters, but they stand with us in this case. At the same time, we are getting a lot of death threats and a lot of hate. And the problem is this, people are very emotional. And because they're so emotional, they're losing sight of law and rationality and the long-term vision. So Trump was smart, in a sense, to use this as his test case because he realizes somebody like Huda, for people who don't know her as an individual, who aren't intimately familiar with the facts of her case, how she was brainwashed, manipulated, how she made horrible mistakes, but at the end of the day, it was a very immature woman who was just taken advantage of and deeply regrets the mistakes she made and is willing to pay her debt to society. People who don't know her as a human, it's very easy for them to have a lot of hate, and I think she brought that upon herself by some of her decisions. So therefore, Trump is thinking, she's not getting a lot of sympathy. Let me use this now to push and set a precedent of my authority to simply declare somebody a non-citizen in contravention of the facts. And in doing so, then we'll open the door for the executive order he's been wanting to do for a long time, where he said, listen, I think people who are, you know, born and their parents don't have the proper documentation, if they're born in U.S. soil, they shouldn't be able to get citizenship, therefore undermining the 14th Amendment, something he cannot do by executive order. But he's hoping this will push his strength to be able to do that.
That's one of the most important points about this. She's a perfect sort of poster child for Trump's larger agenda here, which is to get rid of birthright citizenship, because who's going to stand with somebody who went and joined ISIS? But that's what the Constitution is for. The First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment. These protections are designed so that the government doesn't have unfettered discretion and whereby it targets somebody who is, quote, unpopular or associated with an unpopular cause. depriving them of their rights. And everybody says, oh, good, let's deprive them of their rights because their group is so heinous. But then it's the precedent. And then the whole constitutional order goes down. That's really what's at stake.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head, which is that, you know, Trump can use this because, you know, Huda may not be the most sympathetic character right now to extend his power to strip Americans of citizenship. And many people may celebrate that today. But these are the very same people who can be targeted by that newfound executive power and overreach tomorrow. So in order to protect the Constitution for the best of us, we must protect it for the worst of us.
You know, one of the things here that I think people who follow this case, most people who follow this case don't understand is that there are two separate issues here. Number one is, did Huda Muthanna commit a crime? You can argue that she did. You can argue that she didn't. That's an issue for criminal court. The other issue is the government's overreach on this issue of stripping her, essentially stripping her of her citizenship without due process. That's something that all Americans should be concerned about. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were very happy to be joined from Tampa, Florida by Hassan Shibli. He is the Muthanna family attorney and the executive director of the Florida Council of Islamic Relations at Tampa. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The Australian Ministry of Foreign Affairs acknowledged yesterday that it had issued a passport to WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange in September of 2018 as a result of extended negotiations. It's not clear what Assange would be able to do with the passport. He has sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and he would likely be extradited to the United States if he leaves that building. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin, it's exciting that Julian has a passport for the first time in many years, but what could he do with a passport?
Yeah, that's a big question. So if the UK insists on pursuing some kind of prosecution because he violated bail conditions, then he's could be potentially under arrest. That gets him in a situation where he's back to being afraid that he could be extradited by the UK authorities to the United States. And so I think the overhang around all of this, though, I'll note that I've gone over the Sydney Morning Herald's coverage from Australia. This is an Australian newspaper. I've gone over their report and looked at some of the details closely and seen what some of the local politicians are saying. And though they seem to be willing, at least publicly, they're open to working with Julian to maybe bring him back home. I don't know how possible that is if there's still this overhang of the Justice Department intending to leave charges open as a possibility, that they would like to bring them eventually. So I think there are just very many questions here.
You know, that's a very important point. Julian said from the very beginning that he couldn't leave the embassy because the issue was not the British and this failure to appear warrant, which is there's very little in criminal law that's more minor than a failure to appear warrant. It was the notion that he would be snatched and extradited to the United States. And sure enough, 2 months ago, the Justice Department accidentally revealed that they have secret charges pending against him and he would be extradited to the United States. So he was right about that all along. I'm interested, though, in the fact that the Australians have granted this passport because it came as a result of protracted negotiations, which tells me that there was a specific reason to issue it. Now, it's not clear whether his support for returning to Australia is coming from the government, which at the time right now is a very conservative government in Australia, or if it's coming from the left of center opposition. If it's coming from the opposition, I would venture to say that it's symbolic in nature. If it's coming from the government, I wonder if we're close to seeing some kind of a resolution in this case. What do you think?
So the first thing I would say is that it points out that apparently this former foreign affairs minister, Julie Bishop, she's no longer in charge, but apparently made the decision to grant this passport to Julian because, of course, he is an Australian citizen. And so that's huge. Like that's
it really is.
That's a big deal. And I think like The way that the Sydney Morning Herald reported it, the way I read between the lines, is that there might be, this might have been an individual decision by somebody who had the authority to make it, and that it probably went through the formal process. But it's hard to say at the moment if the government that runs Australia would actually be in favor of what was done.
That would be very, very hard to believe. Now, in the event of some kind of a miracle where the government says, all right, this is dragged on too long, he didn't commit espionage, the U.S. is charging him improperly with espionage, we want him to come home, he could conceivably come home. But we are not aware of any such statement or request. Now, Australia is one of the Five Eyes countries. That's the United States, the UK, Australia, Canada, New Zealand. And the Five Eyes are so close. Their relations in law enforcement and intelligence and counter-narcotics and counter-proliferation, those relationships are so close that they defer to one another. So if the Australian government were to ask the British and the Americans to allow Julian to go home, they would let him go home. But we're not aware, are we, of any such request having been made?
We also have to be mindful of the change in the nature of the Ecuadorian government in the last year or two, and the fact that they might be making overtures to the Australian government to help them resolve this. By resolve, I mean, can you get Julian out of our embassy? We don't want him here anymore. And I think that they take political asylum seriously, and they probably don't want to. I think it might be an embarrassment if they were to cast him loose and fail to get him to Ecuador, fail to secure this type of safety they pledged when you had Correa as the president of Ecuador. And now it's a more centrist government, borderline right of center government. They don't feel the same way about Julian Assange as Rafael Correa did.
That's exactly right. And that's an important point. It's the change in government in Ecuador. This new government wants Julian out. They want to be rid of this problem. They have actively pursued improved economic relations with the United States. The U.S. has promised economic concessions, things like tax-free exports to the United States. And there have even been official visits between Ecuador and the United States. So, yeah, the Ecuadorians want this thing over. To tell you the truth, I think most all of these countries want this thing to be over. But I think the United States, frankly, is hell-bent on prosecuting him, in which case that prosecution would be unique in that Julian is a journalist. And they would be prosecuting not just a journalist, but a foreign journalist under the U.S. Espionage Act.
That's true. And we've had a number of releases in the last 5 to 10 years that they could come down on Julian Assange for being a part of. Each of them have a range of issues. Each of them are separate. The one that might have actually put him in the crosshairs in the last 2 or 3 years is this Vault 7 leaks from the CIA, the release of these hacking materials. I mean, it is beyond, I mean, I'm sure you can attest to this, it's beyond highly classified, the sort of thing he was confirming by releasing these, and the fact that some of these might even amount to blueprints for these hacking tools that other governments could use. At the same time, he's a publisher, and so he wasn't directly involved in purloining this material. So as far as we know, as far as the evidence that we've seen so far, he didn't help solicit and facilitate the hacking and leaking of this material. And so again, you're right, under the Espionage Act, it would be a very novel case, a very dangerous development in the way in which the Espionage Act was pursued to go after Julian Assange and carry out not only a prosecution, but to go to such great lengths to extradite him from foreign country to the United States just for the purpose of a prosecution.
In our last 3 minutes, I want to talk about that Espionage Act. And we've discussed this before, but I think it bears repeating. The Espionage Act was written in 1917 to combat German saboteurs. It doesn't even mention the words classified information because the classification system hadn't even been invented yet. All it says is that a person is guilty of espionage if he or she passes national defense information to any person not entitled to receive it. So if you're going to prosecute someone for espionage, you would likely prosecute the person who gave the Vault 7 documents to WikiLeaks. You wouldn't go after or prosecute the publisher of the documents, just like you wouldn't arrest and prosecute the publisher of the New York Times, for example, or the Washington Post for publishing the Pentagon Papers or really anything. I mean, if you look at the Washington Post or New York Times on any given day, there's classified information on the very front page every single day. And there are no prosecutions of those publishers. Julian is a publisher, too. His publishing is online, but they're going to use the Espionage Act against him. Go ahead and take us out. We have about a minute and a half left.
Absolutely. I think you're making a very important point here. And I would add to it, though, that the one thing that has upset the U.S. government more than anything in the past decade or so is that he's not willing to play gatekeeper, is that his media organization does not care about the agenda of the United States government. He does not operate like a state-identified media organization, which is the way that most corporate news networks and or establishment news media organizations function in the U.S. If they talk to a U.S. official, it does not take very long for them to warm up to their concerns and see it in their way. Even if there are reasons to hold certain institutions accountable, they will still back down from it and sit on very important stories just to reassure or placate people who run our government. And Julian Assange has never been willing to play this kind of game. He's been willing to make publications of materials for the sake of the value of those materials because people need to know certain information. He does not care about the interests of any particular powerful governments, particularly the U.S., and that's why he remains a target of the United States.
That is exactly right. We'll leave it there. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And you can find also the worst headlines that we didn't have a chance to get to. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we're joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome.
Hey.
Hey, everybody.
Steve, as usual, we have a ton of headlines, which is sad in a way because the press is just
every
so
week.
Bad.
They're bad every week.
Or at least the editors are so bad that they give us this much fodder for the show.
We should really thank them.
Where would you like to start?
Well, let's start with Russia and a lesson in how one word can really, you know, screw up a headline. Is a headline from the New York Times. Threatening U.S., Putin promises Russians both missiles and butter.
What?
In the article. And here's a similar headline, even worse, actually, from Time magazine. President Vladimir Putin threatens to retaliate if U.S. deploys new missiles in Europe. Well, of course, threatens, you know, can be used in a wide way. But in general, threatens is a threatening word. It means it's a threat. And really, The Washington Post, remarkably, had a headline which puts these others to shame and shows how one can actually write a headline which tells a story accurately. And the Washington Post headline was, Putin warns new weapons will point toward U.S. if missiles are deployed in Europe. So that's a simple factual statement of what Putin said and what's going to happen. But to the New York Times and Time magazine, it was Putin threatening the United States. It's just a good example of what one word can do.
Indeed, that's very true. So you're on a school playground. Somebody comes up, they threaten to beat the hell out of you, and you say, "If you take one more step, I'm going to do the same to you." And then the headline, the story, the narrative is the person who was the first target of the threat is threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Steve is right that it does leave the impression that there's this ominous force. But again, the Russians have been appealing for the maintenance of these arms treaties and for both sides, if there are differences about compliance, to talk about the compliance
rather than deploy troops. And of course, if Russia or any country has advanced weapons deployed at it and around it, it's going to retaliate. I mean, the U.S. knows this, and that's the arms race is, in fact, underway, the new arms race, to the detriment of everyone. Go ahead, Steve.
And by the way, we've seen exactly the same kind of language in headlines with regard to Iran, with regard to North Korea, and probably other countries as well. I mean, it's just standard that any country which says they will retaliate if the U.S. does something is described as threatening us. I mean, it's actually all too typical.
Well, America first, Steve. You know.
Yeah.
America first, indeed.
Let's move on to this week's what I call fake news by omission, the story that has been buried by the press. And we've talked multiple times about Venezuela and how the press is burying the fact that a lot of the population supports the government. But I want to switch subjects this week to a different one, which is Tulsi Gabbard,
yeah,
who's a presidential candidate. And of all the candidates running for president, she has been almost totally whited out or blacked out. I can't decide which of those words is better, by the media. And some remarkable things, like there was a New York Times article. And the headline was about women running for office, running for president, in fact. And the headline was, "A Woman, Just Not That Woman, How Sexism Plays Out on the Trail." And it talks about Warren and Gillibrand and Harris and Klobuchar, not a mention of Gabbard. Then the Washington Post had an article, "2020 May Be Historic for Women in More Ways Than One." Again, mentions all the other candidates. And finally, in the 14th paragraph, it puts Gabbard's name but doesn't say anything about her. So there's almost total whiteout of her campaign in the press, which is really not coincidental, I would say, given the fact that she's the only candidate taking a strong stand against the ongoing coup attempt in Venezuela, among other things.
I wouldn't say there's a total whiteout, because there are, especially when she first announced, there were a number of articles that were highlighting views from when she was 19 years old that she has apologized for and explained and, vowed.
Repeatedly.
Having to do with her position on the LGBTQ community. She came from a conservative, religious, right-wing background.
So there's plenty of things highlighting those views that she has made extremely clear are no longer views that she holds. She has apologized for. And she's done just about everything that you would want someone to do who held such disgusting views as she did in the past. But to your point, yeah, exactly. Other than those, you really haven't seen much.
Yeah, the most astonishing article, though, just appeared in The Atlantic. It's a Peter Beinart article. And the headline is, "It's foreign policy that distinguishes Bernie this time." And it says, "Sanders arguably talks about foreign policy more than any other declared candidate does." And it actually says, I laughed out loud when I read this, "Over the past 2 years, Sanders has given 2 speeches outlining his broad foreign policy vision." Really? Wow.
Ironically, today's Washington Post says that this is a new Bernie, and he's out there talking about domestic policy because that's what Democrats want to hear. So what is it? They just make this stuff up.
That's what he's always talked about.
He's always been a domestic policy guy, talking about poverty, talking about employment.
Inequality.
And equality jobs. And education, yeah. And jobs. Yeah, always.
So this article, which is about foreign policy, there's not a single mention of Tulsi Gabbard, who, if you listen to her, and I listen to her announcement speech, and I've seen her in one of her town halls, the entire centerpiece of her campaign is the opposition to regime change wars, her demand that we should not get into a new Cold War, we should oppose the breaking of the INF, all sorts of things like this. That's the entire centerpiece of her campaign. And yet, in this article, which talks about foreign policy, there's not a single word about her. I mean, it's just a total, they just don't like her because of her really serious stand on Venezuela. Bernie Sanders, for example, issued a statement on Venezuela, very wishy-washy, back on January 24th. He hasn't had a word to say about it since. I mean, he's really very weak on the subject, even though in principle he opposes U.S. military intervention. But he hasn't had a word to say about sanctions, which are helping to destroy Venezuela.
That's true. And 2 of the media appearances that Tulsi Gabbard has either been in or been, talked about during, one was during the Joe Rogan show where I think it was Barry Weiss who said that she was an Assad toady, but then didn't actually know what that meant. So people are attacking her on foreign policy. And same on The Morning Joe, but they were attacking her in person and said, spouting all kinds of things that weren't true, including that the U.S. said that they went into Syria to fight Assad when they actually went in to fight ISIS. And, she was the one who had to kind of correct the record. So they've been attacking her on foreign policy, but that's the only thing they've been doing. They being the media, of course.
Right. Well, time to turn to bots and trolls, our weekly visiting into bots and trolls. And there's some fun. Here's a funny headline, finally, at last. This is from Bloomberg. Twitter revises data on Russian trolls and social media company says 228 accounts were misidentified. Changes invalidate key points of previous Bloomberg article. So it turns out they found out that a whole bunch of accounts which they had claimed were from the so-called IRA, the Internet Research Association, were actually, they suddenly discovered they belonged to a different trolling network, quote unquote, located in Venezuela. What a coincidence. It just goes to prove how flimsy these claims are, that, you know, one day they say, oh, there's a whole bunch of Russians hacking, interfering in our social media. And all of a sudden, no, it wasn't Russians, it was Venezuelan. I mean, come on, get your story straight.
Steve, when you're reading a funny headline, you're not supposed to announce in advance it's funny. It's like if I say to you, I'm going to tell you a funny joke now.
It's going to be really funny. Get ready.
It was funny, but you kind of spoiled it.
I gotta be honest, though. I'm sure this piece in the Bloomberg website was at the very bottom. As always, these retractions are on the back page, completely hidden.
Right. And here's a similar one. This was in Politico. Sustained and ongoing disinformation assault targets Dem presidential candidates. A coordinated barrage of social media attacks suggests the involvement of foreign state actors. But that's the headline. But when you read the article, it says not all of the activity is organized. Much of it appears to be organic. That is, you know, right-wingers attacking Democrats. And then it says, researchers and others interviewed for this story cannot conclusively point to actors behind the coordinated activity. It's unclear if they are rogue hackers, political activists, which is what they sound like to me, or, as some contend, foreign state actors such as Russia. So they don't have any idea who this is, but in the headline, there it was, suggests the involvement of foreign state actors.
We only have a minute left, Steve. I want to jump in because there was a headline from today's New York Times. It's not funny, so people don't need to laugh in advance.
Venezuela's, I do need to laugh or I don't.
Venezuela's ex-spy chief breaks with Maduro. Quote, you have killed hundreds, close quote. Okay, so who is this? This is Hugo Caraval. Now, as it turns out, when you get to the 15th paragraph of the article, you find out this guy is actually wanted in the United States for drug trafficking, that he has been sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department for drug trafficking. In the interview, he admits to dealing in drug trafficking. And so, wow, he breaks with Maduro. He hasn't been in any intelligence service since 2012.
He's retired.
The headline makes you think, this human rights fighter is breaking with Maduro because he, quote, killed hundreds. And in fact, what this guy is doing, he was a drug trafficker and the U.S. had indictments against him and sanctions against him. But now because he's broken with Maduro publicly, he will be a human rights freedom fighter.
And he found just the right time where I'm sure he won't get charged in the U.S.
That's the kind of deliberate, a pernicious misleading of the public as part of a propaganda effort to overthrow the Maduro government.
Yeah, that was probably the worst one this week, man.
We should end it there, folks.
We are ending it.
Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve joins us every Friday. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And you can also find there the worst headlines we didn't have a chance to get to. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we were joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst, and she's also one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear. Oh,
our land.